straight back to the medical experts on Earth. If it alarmed them, they would have let us know by now, wouldn't they? Or would they be afraid of frightening us, ruining our efficiency? After all, we only have a little over 3 more weeks to go. Perhaps I should discuss it with Reed, he said to himself, as he got up from the communications console. He's our doctor and psychologist. Perhaps he can throw some light on the problem. With a shrug of his heavy shoulders, Voznesensky decided to try to get a good night's sleep instead. I can talk to Reed tomorrow if I still feel worried. Tomorrow will be soon enough. Saul 35. Evening. Who would have thought, complained Ilona, that one could get so tired merely sitting down all day? Long, darkly red shadows were stretching across the sandy, barren landscape. Jamie saw that the sun would be setting in an hour or so. Doing nothing can be more exhausting than hard physical labor, Joanna agreed. All day long, the two women had been either sitting on the folded benches or standing behind the men in their cockpit seats as the rover trundled across the boulder-strewn wilderness toward Tithonium Chasma. Jamie had taken turns at driving with Pete Connors. His head ached from the unrelieved tension. Even when he was in the right-hand seat, he hunched forward in strained concentration, watching anxiously for rocks too big to clamber over or craters too steep to traverse. The land they were traveling across was rough, uneven, rust-red formations of low, flat-topped hills, with a rugged wall of mountains in the distance lining the horizon. Just like the Chinle Formation in Arizona, Jamie said to himself, shaking his head in wonder at the similarities between the two worlds. They had found dinosaur bones in those red rocks back home, he remembered. Anything wrong? Connors asked. Almost startled, Jamie pulled himself out of his reverie. The astronaut was grinning at him good-naturedly. You were frowning as if your shoes are too tight, Connors said. Just thinking about geology, said Jamie. Does it hurt? Jamie laughed and shook his head. A few minutes later, Jamie asked, Pete, what does the T stand for? Why don't you use your first name? Connor's long face sank into a frown. Tyrone, he muttered.
Tyrone?
Don't tell anybody.
Why not? It's a fine old Irish name.
Connor's grin returned, but somehow it looked almost sad. The white kids in Nebraska didn't think so. Got me into a hell of a lot of fights. Didn't look right for the minister's son to have skinned knuckles all the time. Pete is a lot easier to live with. I wonder how many extra battles he had to fight in the Air Force, Jamie thought, and the space agency. They kept on driving as the distant pale sun sank toward the red horizon. Connors was muttering into the microphone of the comm set clipped over his short-cropped hair. Jamie did not have his earphones on, but he knew that the astronaut was checking their position on the satellite-generated photomap and calling in to Voznesensky at home base. According to the display screen in the middle of the cockpit control panel, they were less than 5 kilometers from the canyon. Jamie checked his wristwatch. About 15 minutes of daylight remained. Connors slewed the segmented rover almost 90 degrees off its course and eased it to a stop. The electric generator that powered the wheel motors hummed to a lower pitch. Okay, that's it for today, he said. Before Jamie could ask why he had turned off course, Connors called over his shoulder to the women. Come on up and watch the sunset. They crowded into the cockpit and watched in silence as the strangely small sun sunk below a line of bluffs. The sky turned from pink to burning red, then went utterly black. Jamie strained his eyes for a glimpse of the aurora, but either it was too delicate to be seen through the tinted canopy, or there was none. Maybe it's only there when the sun's active, he guessed. None of them moved. No one said a word. Jamie felt the cold of the Martian night seeping through the plastic bubble of the cockpit. Slowly, as their eyes adjusted, a few of the brightest stars gleamed through the bulbous, tinted plastic. That must be the Earth, Ilona said in her breathy, sultry voice. Nope, it's Sirius, Connors corrected. According to the ephemeris, Earth is already below the horizon.
We cannot see it at all? Joanna asked.
Not until she becomes a morning star, and we'll be on our way home by then. Jamie stared out at the dark night sky. He could see only a sparse sprinkling of stars. The sky looked lonely, abandoned. Connors reached up and pulled the thermal shroud over the plastic canopy. Then, "Could you let me squeeze past, please?" he said to the women. "I've got to get some aspirin." "Headache?" Ilona asked. "Yeah, too many hours driving. It's a lot easier flying a plane."
"Me too," said Ilona. "I'll join you at the aspirin bottle."
Janie wondered if Ilona was going to make a play for the astronaut. Not here, he thought. It's too crowded. There's too much at stake. Then he realized that his own temples were throbbing. It had been a tense day, driving constantly. By the time they finished dinner, though, they all seemed to feel better. Connors regaled them with stories about his days as the tail-end Charlie with the U.S. Air Force's acrobatic flying team, the Thunderbirds. "So we pull out of the loop, wingtip to wingtip, and my goddamn canopy pops off. Pow! Just like that. We're pulling 4 G's and batting along close to Mach 1, and all of a sudden I'm in the middle of a regular hurricane right there in my cockpit." His black face was alive with expression, his hands twisting to show the positions of the airplanes. Both women were listening raptly, their wide eyes riveted on Connors. Jamie listened with half an ear and let his mind wander to the task they would face in the morning, finding a safe slope down the landslide to the floor of the canyon. Would the ground be firm enough to hold them? Would it be too rocky for the rover's wheels? Lee's people up in orbit had fired the last 4 of their geological probes into the canyon. Completely automated, the probes shed their atmospheric heat shields as they neared the ground and then drifted to soft touchdowns on billowing white parachutes. Only one of them had actually sunk its instrument-bearing anchor into the rubble of the landslide itself. The other 3 had missed it by ranges of a few dozen meters to a full kilometer. That one probe's instruments reported that the landslide was firm enough for the rover to traverse, but it was only one spot on the slide. What if there were pockets of loose, powdery soil? What if they got stuck halfway down? To come this close and then have to turn back would be sickening. He realized that Connors had finished his story and gone back to the cockpit for his final check-in with the dome before retiring for the night. Ilona had gone up there with him, sitting in the chair Jamie had occupied most of the day. Joanna was sliding the table into its slot below the lower bunk, opposite Jamie.
"Are you all right?" she asked.
"Hmm? Yes, sure, I'm okay."
"You seem to drift away from us."
"I was thinking." She smiled slightly.
"Not a bad thing for a scientist to do,
on occasion."
"How do you feel?" he asked.
"Oh, tired."
"Worried, I suppose."
"Worried? About what?"
Sitting on the edge of the folded bunk beside Jamie, she said in her whispery voice,
"Suppose we go all this way. Suppose we get to the bottom of the canyon, and there is nothing there, no life."
Janie shrugged. "That's why we're going all this way, to find out if there's life down there or not."
"But suppose we find none?"
There was something in her eyes that Janie could not fathom, something more than anxiety, deeper than a scientist's concern over the outcome of an investigation.
"If there isn't any life to be found down there," Janie answered slowly,
"that in itself is an important discovery. We'll just have to search elsewhere." Joanna shook her head.
"If there is no life beneath the mists, what can we expect from the rest of this frozen desert? We will have failed, Jamie. There will never be another expedition to Mars."
"Hey, don't get so down," he said, reaching out to grasp her shoulder gently. "It won't be your fault if Mars is lifeless."
"But we will have come all this way for nothing."
"No, not for nothing. We're here to learn whatever it is that Mars has to teach us. That's what science is all about, Joanna. It's not a game where you keep score. It's about building up knowledge. The negative results are just as important as the positives. More so, maybe."
The expression on her face was close to misery.
"We're here to seek the truth," Jamie said in an urgent whisper, "and not to be afraid of what we find, whatever it is."
Joanna did not reply.
"There's nothing to be afraid of," he repeated, "no matter what we find, or fail to find."
She turned away, got up from the half-folded bunk, and hurried toward the laboratory. Jamie realized she was crying. He felt sorry for her, and puzzled. As he lay on his back in the darkened rover, listening to the soft wind of Mars just outside the metal skin, Jamie wondered why Joanna was so worried about what they would find in the canyon. "She's a biologist," he told himself. "If she finds life on Mars, her name will go into the history books. But if she doesn't, she'll always wonder if she missed it. The whole world will wonder if there's